Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Literacy View. We have our special guest with us today, second time, because he is Nate the Great Joseph. Also, he has written a book that is hot, hot, hot. It is The Scientific Principles of Reading Instruction, and his actual name is Nathaniel Hansford, but he's better known as Nate Joseph.
You gotta keep those students away from you on social media, guys.
Exactly, exactly. So Nate has been a teacher for 11 years, and he has taught in three countries and multiple Canadian provinces. He holds a specialist qualification in reading instruction and in special education. And he is particularly interested in researching and writing about the science of teaching via a meta-analysis perspective. And we are so happy to have Nate with us today. And the discussion is going to be about Nate's article, "Are SOR Laws Working?" And you can find that article on teachingbyscience.com, or if you were to Google pedagogy non grata, you would find it as well. So welcome, Nate. We're so happy to have you. And I think I'm just going to jump right in. So are SOR laws working? I'm going to throw that question to you. Now, Judy and I read the article, but I want to hear what you have to say, and then we'll start talking about it.
Yeah, you know, it's a really tough question to answer, I think. And I wouldn't have originally thought to look at this question, but a research firm recently reached out to me to ask me my thoughts on what percentage of students could get to grade level and how best could we do it. And they actually paid me to do 20 hours of research on this topic. And that was LXD research, by the way. And it just expanded to a whole series of articles after I was finished researching for them, because it was such an interesting topic. And I thought this whole science of reading laws part was a really important question, because I think this is where the science of reading movement's actually going to get its greatest criticism. You see so much criticism of structured literacy and phonics, not so much focusing on the experimental literature and the scientific studies, but focusing on this large state level data, like, oh, X state passed this law. Why aren't we seeing, you know, a huge impact if the science of reading is real? So I thought it was important to kind of take this lens. And it's kind of interesting to look at this lens, because it's like doing a study with millions of students in it. And I want to say before I even say, is it working or not working? There's a huge caveat to research done in this way, in that, we get this really large standard sample, and actually we have a second bonus. Everybody's using the same assessment. So we know the measurement's the same across the study, and it's a standardized assessment. So on its face, it seems like a really good sample or study. And then on top of that, we actually equated states to do this. So we took 12 states that were identified as having a science of reading law passed prior to 2019. Which was the second last time we had NAP scores done. And we matched them to states that had equivalent scores that did not pass a science of reading law. So we have equivalence at start. We have a humongous sample. We have a standardized measurement that's the same for every single state. So it looks great on principle. There is one flaw in this type of research, I think, and that we don't know what's going on actually in each individual school. Because just because science of reading law is passed in a state doesn't mean that that's actually being implemented with fidelity. In fact, I can't count the number of schools I've worked in over the years in three different countries where all the curriculum documents and binders just sat dusty on shelves and nobody ever looked at them. I think that's pretty normal. So I want to give that
criticism of my own. I'll tell you everything.
Dave, you know, Nate just used the F word. You use the F-bomb, fidelity.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Go ahead, Nate. Sorry about that.
Yeah, so overall, we saw no statistical difference between states that passed science reading laws versus states that did not, which I feel like, anyone who's pro balanced literacy would hear that and be like, yes, all right, Nate is on our side now. And I want to add a lot of caveats to that. First off, as I said, we don't know what's going on at the ground level. So it's really difficult. And then we decided to take that analysis deeper, because it's one thing to say, okay, overall, is this having an impact? But I think you have to look at different types of laws. And what we found is different policies were more effective than others. So there were certain policies that seemed to make a much bigger difference in improving reading outcomes than others. So if we look on the overall broad trend across the 12 states who passed science and reading laws that we included, yeah, there was not a statistically significant difference. But if we look at specific states and specific policies, well, then we can start to get a much more clear picture. And I think I can say that the research does suggest quite strongly, in my opinion, that certain policies are effective at improving reading results.
Yeah. So I noticed that Arkansas seemed to be doing very well compared to other states. And as you mentioned in the article, you said that this has been implemented now for 4 years. Mm. And you mentioned the secret sauce that you think is there in Arkansas, besides it being over 4 years, which of course could, be interesting to look at because it's been in effect now for a while. What's the secret sauce in Arkansas?
Well, I think one of the advantages that Arkansas has is that it did apply its science reading law a little earlier than some of the other states. So when mm-hmm. we looked at when we did a correlation analysis to try and see if time mattered, because we said all states had to have passed their law before 2019. However, some of those states passed their laws much earlier. So some states had only 3 years, Arkansas had four. So that's an advantage right there, because we noticed that the longer the state had passed the law, the more effective it was on average. The other unique thing I think about Arkansas is that they're the only state in our list of states that we included that fully banned 3Qing, where it was like explicitly stated in the legislation that 3Qing is banned. Now, that said, because it's the only state that did this, I think it's a more difficult comparison, because for other factors, I could point to three or four states and be like, these three or four states did this, no other states did it, and this was the difference when we compared them to the states that did not. So I want to be careful when I say that Arkansas was successful because they banned 3Qing. I think I would call it an interesting tidbit. You know, it suggests that there might be something there, but I think we need more research. And in general, I think 3Qing is actually under-researched, which is funny because it's so hotly debated on both sides of the reading wars. And yet I think it's one of the most poorly researched elements. Now, I could make an argument against 3Qing based on the research, and I would be happy to do so, but I almost feel like that would sort of distract from today's topic of conversation.
So, Judy, one thing that Nate mentioned in this article was that the five pillars of literacy were important to cover, as well as systematic phonics, as well as coaching.
Woohoo!
Certainly, this got my attention. Your thoughts about any of those five pillars, systematic phonics, coaching?
All right. So
what say you?
That's funny that you say that. You're speaking my love language. So I didn't take a lot of notes tonight because it's been a long day at work. You know, I get on the train at 6:22 in the morning, coach all day, look at data all day, model lessons all day. But here I am. And those were some of the key points that I put down. Now, I thought it was really interesting. I mean, I wanted the numbers to be a little bit higher. I saw that, you know, systematic phonics is super important. There's no doubt in my mind. I don't care. I'm not a researcher. I see it in the field, right? I'm boots on the ground. I'm sitting there seeing if it's implemented well and kids are being able to decode words that they could never decode before. And they're making those connections. That's huge, right? Five pillars of literacy. That is Faith, I know why you're laughing, because people on some episodes said, oh, I don't believe in this and the five pillars and you got to throw in the knowledge building. We know, but there are some key components that we all know as professionals need to be in those classrooms that we're missing for a very long time and not emphasized. We know phonemic awareness is important. We know that phonics is important. We know that phrasing and fluency is important. We know vocabulary is important. We know comprehension is important. And now we're focusing a lot on knowledge building and so forth. Those are all big pieces of the pie. I was a little upset that number, I think Nate's number, and I'm not, I like data, like Acadian's data. I don't know about this meta-analysis and all of that regular analysis.
Well, this isn't really a meta-analysis, to be fair, but.
It's not, right? Yeah, I know. I'm getting there, Nate. So I saw 2.94. It was something, right? Something. I'll take it. And then it said literacy coaches, which I am still a literacy coach at the moment. And I think I'm pretty effective, but we'll see. 3.39. But the most interesting point was that I saw for the greatest effect, it had to be a combined approach. And that totally makes sense to me. I saw that the number, I think it's significant. I mean, mathematicians might not think it's significant, but at 5.07 as a combined effect, I think that's something. But, you know, like Nate was saying, there's going to be issues, right? Implementation is an issue. Training of teachers is an issue. You know, there's still a lot of teachers in the field. They're teaching kids how to decode, but they don't fully understand the science behind all the syllable types. Maybe some of those teachers just got to teaching CVC words and, oh, yes, that silent E, it didn't come up yet. We have all the vowel teeth. You know, so there's so many pieces. And I think that Arkansas piece is very interesting because things to shift, they don't just happen like, whoop, things take time, right?
Yeah, yeah. They certainly do. So let's talk about each one of these. So systematic phonics. We know that phonics is important, but Nate, you specified a when and how much pretty much here, as well as tier three, and how many hours should be spent in this. Could you talk about that? I find that to be very interesting.
Yeah, so I got that research actually from Torgerson et al. And I was originally trying to look up this claim that 95% of students can learn how to read, which is a popular claim in the science of reading community. But I often didn't see citations for it. And I dug into the research on that. And I eventually came to a literature review by Torgerson done in 2009. And he was actually inspired by someone else who did the literature review in 2002. So I went through both literature reviews, and in that process, I came across two additional studies that sort of fit into that inclusion criteria, in which we had more than 95% of students reading in them. And then I looked at, well, what happened in these studies where 95% of students or higher were reading? In fact, in my analysis, 97.5% of the students were reading on grade level. So where we had the highest level of success in these studies were schools where 82% of students were reading on grade level to start with. And where tier three instruction was provided to all struggling readers in the school, and it was provided in groups of 1 to 3 students at a time, so 3 being the max, 1 being the lowest, and there was provided with a minimum of 80 hours of additional instruction throughout the school year. And then when I broke that down a little further than Torgerson and math, because they didn't break it down according to instructional type, but if we did systematic phonics instruction versus balanced literacy, because many of the studies they did were balanced literacy and systematic phonics, and we were able to get an even higher percentage of students up to grade level if we did a structured literacy approach or a systematic phonics approach, I should say, during that 80 hours. So I thought that was really interesting to point out that all of the studies where we have this really high level of success had those commonalities. Now, I think the criticism of that is, but doesn't necessarily show us what is normal or typical in a classroom. Like, I don't know that every school that has those elements in place will reach 95% of students reading on grade level, but it shows that the schools that have done it and have documented it in scientific literature did have those things in place. So I think it suggests those are very important and necessities if we want to reach those highest levels of success in schools.
And what grade are you talking about? I think that's important.
That's a really good point too. So all of these studies were in grade 1 and 2, actually, for reading intervention. I didn't see any studies for intervention in K in kindergarten that looked at this. I didn't see any studies that were older. And I think that kind of makes sense. We have a lot of research, like Colby Hall's meta-analysis last year. It was the most comprehensive meta-analysis on the topic of reading dyslexia or reading interventions for dyslexic students, showed that the impact of a reading intervention was halved by grade three in comparison to grade one. So it was half as effective in grade three if we had intervened in grade one. But there's very few kindergarten intervention studies, which makes sense when you think, like, we don't have a lot of data on students in kindergarten. And some of them are like 5 years old. Like, I don't know that we know enough to know which students are our most struggling readers in kindergarten. I know there's some people who would strongly disagree with me on that point, but I haven't seen a lot of scientific studies on intervention in kindergarten. So I think where we seem to see the strongest benefit in the research or have the most documented benefit is in grade one. And then when we see those high, really high levels of success, it seems to be that we had systematic phonics instruction used, and we had 80 hours plus, and it was in groups of 1 to 3.
So Judy, what Nate is saying, that first grade magic number makes a lot of sense to me. I'm sure it makes sense to you since you are a reading recovery teacher. And that's when.
No, I'm not.
I said you were a reading recovery teacher. And of course, that's the year, right?
Right.
First grade. Yeah. So there was a reason that they did reading recovery in first grade. What they were doing is, you know, something that maybe we could ask some questions about, because as we said before, maybe not enough phonics, right? Or the type of phonics that was being done was not, as Nate said, systematic phonics is a lot different. So your thoughts on that early intervention, early literacy piece, Judy?
All right. So a lot of things were said and I have some thoughts. So one of the things I'm noticing in the field now is, you know, the units in a lot of the phonics programs, there was a lot of like reteaching of concepts going on and people weren't moving forward in the units. So kindergarten, it's very important for kids to get exposure to a lot of the concepts. And like a lot of kids in the early ages, they have trouble with decoding CBC words. But that's not something that just stops. That's something that cycles over and over and over again. So it's so important to make sure that kindergarteners get exposures to the concepts rather than just stopping. And they get more practice and more practice and more practice. And, you know, you mentioned reading recovery. And yes, that was a part of who I was, right? In 2013, that was my life. It hasn't been my life for 7 years. And, you know, looking back, like I said, there were many amazing pieces to that, right? I learned how to watch kids. I learned how to see what they're doing, what they're doing when they come to a word they don't know. However, there was a big gap, and I've spoken about this on many episodes, and I'm not embarrassed to do so. There was phonics there. Was it systematic? No. And was I really confident in my ability to teach phonics skills at that point in my career? I wasn't. We know leveling is the problem, right? So I used leveled books. Even with leveled books, which I don't agree with for the early levels or for beginner readers, had I known more phonics and spoken that phonics language and say, okay, let's make the sounds in the CBC word, or, you know, this is a vowel team and it says E, so let's slide through it and say team. I didn't have that knowledge, and it's plain wrong that I didn't have that knowledge.
So I want to just stop a second. So I think if we start in kindergarten and we start.
I think we should start earlier than kindergarten.
Or earlier. Yeah. Then we would hope with lots of reinforcement that this should be a focus. Now, there's when we talk about the five pillars, Nate, you know, Where does the phonics fit in, or does it shift as they get older? I mean, I'm kind of asking a rhetorical question right now. I know the answer, but I think it's important to explain this to people because, you know, when we talk about balance, yes, that includes the five pillars, but how you teach it and when you teach it and how deeply you teach something will change. For instance, I'm in a school district in the Lynbrook School District, and they are in the process of changing this. We are finishing year two. We started in kindergarten with Sounds Right. And this year we dropped it down to universal pre-K, not with Sounds Right, but by doing things differently in pre-K to prepare kids for when they get up to kindergarten, so that when Sounds Right is implemented officially, these kids are not being confused. And then it's being taken up to first grade. And that is a huge focus. We are focusing on that phonics piece. That doesn't mean that everything else is being pushed away. It just means we know K to two, getting this right is of utmost importance. So Nate, your thoughts on some of what I just said.
Yeah, I have so much to say about that actually. First off, I just want to say that it's so important. I think that when we look at the tier three research or the intervention research, that we get a high level of success from core instruction alone, that we get roughly 80% of students reading at grade level just from core instruction. And we went through a large number of studies trying to find examples of studies where they achieved success or where they achieved 80% or higher of students reading at grade level. And almost all of the studies that we found where they were reading at this really high grade level were in kindergarten. And in these kindergarten studies, they were phonics-based studies. So to me, that shows that it's really important to make sure that we have phonics in kindergarten. And there are experimental studies showing phonics instruction works in pre-K. So I'm not against phonics in pre-K, but I don't know that the research shows the same level of necessity for getting students to grade level. Because when we look at these studies where the students achieve grade level, most of them are in kindergarten, not pre-K, not grade one for core instruction. It's mostly grade kindergarten. And I think that shows to me that at the minimum, we should be starting phonics in kindergarten. And I actually agree. I'm not sure if it was Judy or Faith who said this, that we should probably start phonics in pre-K. Personally, yeah. It just wasn't something that I found strong evidence for in this analysis. But I think there's other types of analysis that do show that phonics works on pre-K. And I strongly believe that we should teach phonics in pre-K. Maybe not day one. Maybe we need to teach some other skills first. But I do think at some point in the year. And then in regards to this five pillars of literacy instruction, I think this idea really comes back to the National Reading Panel report, which showed that it looked at five basic types of instruction and showed, did meta-analyses on them and showed that these were all highly effective at improving literacy outcomes for students. And this is something I've heard Timothy Shanahan talk a lot about. Shout out to him. I think he's the leading expert in the world on the science of reading, if I'm being honest. And he often talks about the importance of including the five pillars of literacy instruction in schools and in literacy education. And I think he's right. And it's funny, like, I actually think in my book, The Scientific Principles of Reading Instruction, I reviewed every meta-analysis I could find on reading instruction. And I kind of found the same thing, although I kind of added a sixth pillar being morphology. But I found there was these basic types of instruction that we had really strong scientific research showed worked. And most other ideas we have far less science showing they're effective. So I think it makes sense to focus on these pillars of instruction, of basic practice instructional teaching methodologies, where we know we have a strong body of scientific literature showing they work. So I was kind of hypothesizing when I looked at the study that we would see, or when I did this study that we're talking about today, that the five pillars of literacy instruction being mandated in an off-state level would improve literacy outcomes. And it was actually one of my only hypotheses that proved to be correct. Most of my hypotheses were completely wrong. But that one proved to be correct. In fact, from a pedagogical perspective, like a teaching methodology, it was the most important. And I think this goes back to this idea of balanced literacy. You kind of hinted at this yourself. You know, the idea that we need balance in schools and the types of instruction we give is true. It's correct. It's important. And but my biggest criticism of balanced literacy approaches is I don't think they're balanced. They over prioritize fluency and comprehension instruction, and they under prioritize phonemic awareness and phonics.
In the early grades, right. Yeah, let's say that.
Yeah. And I want to get back to that other point you made about how having a balance doesn't mean that we have an equal balance in every grade. And this is another thing that I've heard balanced literacy people say that kind of grinds my gears a little, is that, well, we need equal fluency and comprehension instruction in grades 1 and 2 or kindergarten. I don't know that there's a ton of value of a ton of time spent on comprehension instruction in a kindergarten classroom. They don't have texts that are deeply abstract where they have lots of figurative language where it takes deep thinking to understand. They have texts like "the cow jumped over the moon" because they want simple words that are easily decodable for the students to understand. There is no deeper context. So comprehension has to be taught orally. So it's not really a part of reading instruction when you teach comprehension at these lower grades. So does that mean that I think we should teach no comprehension in kindergarten? No, I think it's okay to teach some comprehension. I think it's a good idea. But do I think we need to have, 20% of our day in kindergarten is phonemic awareness, 20% of our instructional day is phonics, 20% is comprehension, 20% is fluency, 20% is vocabulary? No, I think that doesn't make sense. And it goes the reverse too, because we don't have research really supporting the idea that phonics should be taught in every grade. And I think this is sometimes a controversial statement. It shouldn't be, but we don't have research suggesting that, say, that phonics should be taught in grade 7 and grade 8. We really only have research showing phonics should be taught up to like grade 3 max in core instruction. Now, whenever I say that, somebody always tells me, well, what if I have a really struggling class? Can I teach phonics then? And my answer is, of course. This is another place where I think actually sometimes balanced literacy people are correct. Because I'll sometimes see balanced literacy people saying, well, you need to consider the students in front of you. Right. Well, actually, I agree with them on that. I think I have had in my experience as a teacher, older classes that were struggling, and I gave some phonics in my instruction to those students. I think it's perfectly fine to be like, hey, this class scored really lowly on my assessments. I'm going to give more phonics and phonemic awareness, even though the research says I shouldn't.
Can I stop you for a second? Because maybe you're getting kids in those upper grades who need it because it wasn't taught very well in kindergarten and first grade.
1,000%.
The whole class. Think about it. If you're getting a whole class where they can't decode very well in seventh grade, that's a red flag to that district that maybe they really need to look at their tier one instruction differently. But I would think so. To me, that makes sense. That's number one. Number two, what you're saying is pretty much what our guest Maureen Ruby said. So we had Maureen Ruby on, and I hope people will tune into that episode. I knew Maureen from Reading First. And of course, you'll hear people say all these things about Reading First. It didn't work. It's all about phonics, blah, blah, blah. But you said something very interesting, Nate. It's all about implementation. Cool. I was in many Reading First schools because I was a regional reading coach. That's what I did. I went into schools and I watched how this was being implemented. And it wasn't being implemented with fidelity the way it was meant.
Oh, my God. Now you use the F word.
Well, the F word. Right. So then it wasn't. And certainly phonics was not being emphasized in those earlier grades because there was this shift that kept going back and forth and a lot of controversy over that. In any case, getting back to what you said in this article, you mentioned it's really about coaching, not materials.
I just say that blew my mind.
Okay.
I expected the exact opposite.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised because what Maureen said. And she said there's no perfect program and that it's up to districts to really know the standards and fill in the gaps.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think a lot of people have reached out to me to tell me that that was a part that they really felt, that they felt like, yes, coaching is important. And I use two different types of analysis in this. I used basically, for lack of a better word, I use a random effect analysis and a fixed effect analysis. And in the random effect analysis, the coaching outcomes were really, really high. It was like 7% improvement. Now, 7% doesn't sound like a lot, but when we're looking at these big state level studies, it's huge. It's humongous. And I kind of expected materials to have the biggest impact now, which is not what I want, because, you know, I'm someone who writes about basically coaching, and I'm someone who has books on the science of reading. So it's not really helpful to me to say that, well, I'll just go out and buy, you know, a program that's great and you're covered. But at the same time, the research into coaching that's experimental, like scientific research on coaching, where they go into a school and they give teachers literacy coaching, and then they measure, do they do better than a school that didn't get the coaching? Those studies all seem to show low results. And yet the studies where we do give teachers a program and don't give them coaching seem to show much higher results. So I was really kind of confuddled by that, because just giving a program and nothing else actually showed negative results in this analysis. And I would have guessed the opposite. And my kind of guess as to why programs might work better is because I would hope a good program is sort of, for lack of a better word, dummy proof, in the sense that a good program should be something that anyone can use. And it doesn't require a lot of fidelity, and it's easy to implement. That's what I would hope, at least. Whereas coaching, you know, it's complicated. Like, the science of reading is complicated, and planning lessons on, you know, a science-based approach is difficult. And I think it takes a long time to learn about these types of instructional practices. So I would have guessed that, like, just giving them like tools that they could use would be more effective. And I'm not exactly sure why giving people tools on the state level doesn't seem to work. Because if we look at, like, on a study level, if we look at experimental studies, it does seem to work. So clearly something is not matching between scientific studies and what's actually happening on a state level and in classrooms. Maybe it's because the length of this was 3 years, because we waited 3 years in between NAP results. And there's really, I don't know of any phonics studies that are 3 years long. So maybe that's the difference here, that, you know, maybe a program helps teachers for 6 months, but it doesn't make a statistically significant difference over a 3-year time span. Or maybe coaching is way more effective over a 3-year time span than is giving people a program. My other thought is maybe just states are really bad at picking programs. Because when I do look at state lists on programs, I have some questions about how they selected the programs that they did. So I kind of wondered if that was why materials didn't work, but I don't know. And this is, I think I used to really care about the why, and over the years I've become much less concerned about why something works or doesn't work, and just become concerned about what does work. Because from a science perspective, answering the question of why is really, really difficult, but it's kind of easy to answer the what question. And I feel like people, they get really invested into the why. And it's so easy to get proven wrong. If I had hypotheses, like 3 or 4 hypotheses for this article that all got proven wrong. and I'm someone who spent years researching the science of reading, and I would have thought I'd be reasonably good at it at this point, but apparently not. Most of my hypotheses were wrong. So it's almost easier, I think, to just say, hey, this is what we know based on what's available to us in the evidence.
Yeah, I love that you admit this so freely, Nate. It's so refreshing that you're like, yeah, I was wrong about this.
Yeah, he's humble. He's
exactly
humble. And so, he keeps it moving, right? He learns something new, he says it. And then, you know, we try it. And then if the research changes, we have to shift again. That's part of the process.
Yep, that's life, really. So, Judy, this idea of coaching and not materials. You know, we talked to Maureen and we talked about curriculum. And one of the things that did come up was this content-rich curriculum that many people are talking about. And we said how important knowledge is. But at the same time, Maureen said, you can't teacher proof, if you remember, by putting in the perfect program, because that's not going to happen. There's no perfect program. But we should look at this the other way. And we should try to curriculum proof by building teachers. That's pretty much what she said, that we could curriculum proof anything if we have knowledgeable teachers. And she talked about the just ready teacher with us, right? That instead of just always looking to do tons and tons of professional development and reinventing the wheel, we want to try to build teachers up at the university level and having them come in with a certain skill set to be able to do this. Maybe that's why the coaching is so important here, because that's the pivotal piece, is the teacher. Your thoughts on coaching as a coach?
All right. So I have a lot of thoughts. It's funny. I had the word resources written down before you guys talked about it. I also had data collection written down and a whole bunch of other terms. So I think, honestly speaking, I think literacy coaches could be a game changer. I really do. Especially somebody like me, right? I'm not afraid. I'm modeling lessons. Then, you know, I'm releasing some responsibility with co-teaching together. You know, the proof is in the pudding. Like, you know, old school ways of some coaches, they would come in, not from the DOE, but other coaches, they would come in, they would just watch people, give people feedback and not get down and dirty. I think effective coaches means getting down and dirty with those kids, modeling those things, showing what it means to echo something, like even how you hold baby Echo in Foundations. I'm holding him out. Why? That's for the kids to echo. The teachers have to see that. But I think that those resources are really important. I think maybe resources didn't come as high on the list, because if you just give a teacher a resource and say, here, they might not be likely to use it. But if you're working in a coaching cycle and you're like, somebody says to you, oh my God, Judy, they're doing fine in Foundations, but oh my God, they're still not reading. What do I do? And then you have that rich, impactful discussion of looking at the data as a team, right? Seeing what's going on oral reading fluency. And then you're like, you both listen to the kid reading and you see the child is having trouble decoding those words, and they could do it in phonics instruction, but can't do it in text. What does that mean? Hey, I think the kids might need some decodable text. Let's look at these resources together and see it in action. I think that's a big piece of it. Not just saying, here's your tools. You know, like at some point I was given a Foundations box. When was it? Like 7 years ago, and I was afraid to open it, right? I didn't have anybody showing me how to use it.
I wrote about that in my book, about literally unpacking the material.
I was petrified. Yeah. And then, you know, I had the luxury of being sent to the city to see Foundations training in action, right? And then I wasn't scared anymore. And then they told me what to try in the field. And then I tried it. And then I was like, holy shit, I'm in love. This was the missing piece in literacy. Why the hell wasn't I teaching kids how to decode well? It's because I didn't have that knowledge. And that's why I'm so lucky to have Nate in my life, because he keeps enlightening my life. Yeah, Nate, you're really helpful.
Did you know, Nate, that you're the man in her life?
No, I have a different man in my life, but Nate is one of the big guys. We're honoring men this month, and Nate has been a really big piece of it, you know. And another great person that's been a big piece of it is Wiley. You know, he's coming on next. Boom, I read a book of his, and I learned everything about teaching kids how to decode in 2 pages. Where the hell were these 2 pages when I was in college for my master's, for my undergraduate? Why did it have to take me reading Wiley's book and reading Nate's studies to get more familiar with what the hell needs to happen in those classrooms? It gets me a little bit upset, but, you know, I'm a thoughtful person, right? Next year, I see some of the data still not where it should be in schools, right? People are going to be like, oh, phonics isn't working. This isn't working. Change takes time. Data doesn't shift overnight. And, you know, once the kindergarten gets stronger, the first grader is going to come up a little bit stronger.
You know what?
Once graders come up, the second graders are going to come up stronger. But the other thing is, you know, we talk a lot about tier one. Now I'm glad Nate finally somebody mentioned tier three, because that is so damn important too. But I got to tell you, tier two, that's important too. And I don't know if Nate has the numbers and research to support that yet, but it's common sense. Kids are reading a passage, right? You're reading a Geode's passage with the whole class. You're doing it together. You're doing it chorally. You're echo reading. Some kids are still having trouble. They're almost there. Why not take that passage in a smaller group and look at that same passage and do it with extra support? So my point is, I get a little bit upset because like people expect change overnight. Even me, I'm looking at some of the data and I'm like, holy cow, these second graders, oh my God, they're doing well on tests, but that oral reading fluency, they're still in the red. But it's just a process. It just doesn't happen instantly.
Okay, so you mentioned a couple of things, Judy. And you talked about, no, not good, but just what you mentioned, kindergarten, building up kindergarten, and then that affects first grade, and first grade then affects second grade. I have to tell you, the district I'm in, Nate, as a consultant, I'm working with them, and I go in and I do the embedded coaching like Judy was talking about. They started in kindergarten. They didn't make this change in the whole district right away. They started one grade at a time. This year, the focus is first grade. Next year, it will be second grade. But there's this cohort that's moving up. They started with changing phonics and putting a real spotlight on phonics. My question to you, Nate, is because Judy mentioned tier three, you said 80 plus hours. Talk about that a bit, because that's a lot, 80 plus hours. I'm thinking a half hour a day, that's 2.5 hours a week. On average, maybe 10 hours a month, 80 hours. Well, there you go. Like that, that's a lot. So are districts really getting this type of tier three, 80 plus hours instruction with a focus on phonics in those early grades? Your thoughts, Nate?
I don't think so. And I think that's something that's really missed. So one of the things I also looked at in this analysis of the state level laws was an increased focus of tier three instruction. A lot of these states said, well, tier three instruction needs to be mandatory. We need early screening. Students who are struggling need to be given additional instruction. That's great. But I don't remember seeing any that mandated like a specific amount of time of instruction. And it's not so much that we were trying to find what was normal. We took a look at these studies where the results were already high, and we knew the results were high. And then we looked, what was the commonality between these studies? And in all of them, there was a minimum of 80 hours of instruction. I didn't find a single study with less than 80 hours of instruction where the students got to grade level at high levels. So to me, that says that part of this comes down to funding. Like if states and districts want to make it a priority to get most students or the majority of students to grade level in reading, well, then we have to say the funding has to be there for the tier three instruction. And I think that's kind of an elephant in the room. I think I see a lot of people on Twitter talking about how if we implement the science of reading, 95% of students can read. And I don't think just implementing evidence-based practices in the classroom is enough to get 95%. We need to have the resources, the human resources available to students if we want to reach these really high levels. And I'm not aware of too many states or districts that offer 80 hours plus of instruction to struggling readers. And I don't necessarily blame any school for that, because I'm sure it comes down to funding. How many districts are getting the funding that allows that to be possible? So it's kind of an uncomfortable thing in the sense that it means that if states want to have really high literacy levels and really high levels of success, it's going to cost something. It's not free. But I think also the tier three instruction is only one point. In these studies where we had high level success, like I said, there was already a high percentage of students reading at grade level prior to the interventions even happening. So we got to get that core part in place. And that comes down to, I think, evidence-based instruction. And I think a lot of people will point to class size. And actually, the research, as far as I can tell, on class size does not show really strong correlations to reducing class sizes and improving instructor and achievement levels. And I think that I think about in terms of, you know, teachers, I would imagine instructional practice has a bigger difference than the number of students. So, and I'll give a hypothetical. You have two teachers. Teacher A teaches a structured, systematic phonics approach in their class. Everything is backwards planned. Everything is explicit. And they take the time to go over the material in a scaffolded way. Teacher B has half the number of students, but they're not explicit. They're not systematic. It's not backwards planned. It's a lot of inquiry-based learning. It's a lot of guided reading in that class. Do I think that they're going to be higher level success in classroom B? No, I don't. I think classroom A will have higher levels of success. And I think that's kind of validating the research. Meta-analyses typically show higher results for studies that are pedagogy focused than class size focused. And it's actually the same thing it looks like for income. Meta-analyses on income levels seem to show that income has a less of an impact than we would assume. Wow. And I think that's sort of counterintuitive in a sense. I think if you ask the average person, how do we increase the number of students at grade level? They would tell you, well, the students who are coming from poor districts aren't going to succeed. And they're going to tell you that we got to reduce class sizes. But I don't think the research supports that. I think it's evidence-based classroom instruction. And then it's sufficient tier three instruction. It really comes down to the two factors that matter the most.
Yeah. Well, you know, I could tell you again, I keep bringing up Lynbrook, but everything you're saying is what I'm seeing. They reduced the number of kids in their tier three intervention so that the interventionist could take fewer kids, even to the point of doing one-on-one with children, because there were so many kids doing well, having this very explicit phonics approach with, you know, explicit language, everybody talking the same language. And of course, I was also in their coaching on a weekly basis last year in the kindergarten classrooms. And this year across first grade and special ed classes, and the coaching was regular. So everything that you're saying seems to make sense to me. So let's switch gears to these laws, because that actually was the name of the article, right? So now let's talk about the laws, because a lot of people are very much for having this in writing, having states be held to certain standards and laws. And some of them don't really do very much. And people might get upset. You even said, it might sound as if I'm against this, but you're not. It's just that you're just, you know, don't shoot the messenger. You're just kind of saying what you're seeing. So could you talk a little bit about the legislation and implementation? Because those are two areas that you mentioned here, legislation and implementation.
Yeah. So, you know, part of why I did this analysis is I figured it was only a matter of time before someone who was really not in favor of the science of reading did this type of analysis. And I wanted to be able to do it first so I could have a better understanding of what was going on. Because when you look at these really high sample size studies, you almost always see low effects. And I think it comes down to the fact that what you want to be happening in the classroom is not necessarily going to actually be happening. So I think if we actually had systematic phonics and the five pillars of literacy implemented and mandated across schools in a whole state, I think you would see a very large effect. That would be my hypothesis, at least. But I think the difference between achievement and what we see is probably in part due to this fidelity thing, not to drop the F word. on the show. Well, I haven't dropped the Lucy Calkins word either.
Oh no! Uh-oh, here we go. Nate, drink up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have a beverage. I apologize.
He's a friend that just put his baby to sleep.
But you know, when I looked at these laws, I had a kind of concern because it just felt like there were so many things in them that I worry that it's almost like we're shifting so much focus across so many different things that I kind of worried that how well could any of these things be implemented when there's so much in them in the first place. I almost wanted it to be simple. This actually led me, by the way, to the hypothesis to that a shorter bill would be more effective than a longer bill. And I actually tested this and I was wrong. My hypothesis failed. So it did seem that more comprehensive bills weren't a bad thing. But I'm not going to pick on any state here, but I did see some things that were not evidence-based or not well-studied, recommended in some of these laws and mandated. And I got to be honest, that made me slightly uncomfortable seeing things mandated in law that didn't really seem to have a strong research base from what I could confirm. But when I looked at the states that had the lowest results, they tended to focus on materials. They tended to focus on assessment, which I kind of makes sense to think, you know, if you just change the assessment but not the instruction, obviously nothing's going to change. And the other thing they did was they focused more on the university level, changing the training of teachers at universities. But that makes sense that that wouldn't have an immediate effect when you think about it, because those teachers aren't even necessarily in the workforce yet. And if they are, they're first-year teachers. So I wouldn't imagine that would have a strong impact. Mm-hmm. But again, what I saw was that if they included systematic phonics, if they included the five pillars of literacy instruction and mandated that all classrooms or all schools had to be teaching the five pillars, and if they had coaching to help guide teachers through this process, that's where we saw the highest results. Which there are at least two parts of that seem to be well established already in the scientific literature. Like we already know there are many meta-analyses looking at the five pillars of literacy, maybe not all at once, but in each individual piece, showing that they're very effective at improving instructional results. And we have many meta-analyses showing that systematic phonics improves educational results. So I think
Can I interject? So yeah. Why is each state making its own laws? Why isn't it coming down like on a federal level, like so that it's more uniformed? Why is it like state by state by state by state?
I mean, I think that's a constitutional question. I don't know about the United States because I haven't studied your constitution as well as my own. But in Canada, constitutionally, it's a provincial issue. So the federal government has no authority over education in Canada. Only the provinces can pass legislation. And we're doing the same thing. Most of the provinces seem to be mulling over the idea of a science of reading law right now, but they're all doing it individually, separate from each other. There's no one law coming down. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's almost an advantage to that because now we have this fun little thing where all these states are passing different laws and we can monitor all these states over time. And if one state starts to really excel past other states, we can go take a look at what's going on in that state and say, hey, they must be doing something right. So I think there is some advantage to having a state level. It stops the disaster of one person coming in and implementing, or one president coming in and implementing a terrible.
I think it's kind of exciting for New York City. You know, I'm a New Yorker. I live in Connecticut, but born and raised in Brooklyn. It's interesting because in New York, every time there's a new mayor and chancellor, you're starting at square one. So maybe now that the state level changes will be made, regardless of a new mayor or a new chancellor, hopefully things will remain positive. What do you think, Faith?
Well, all I'm thinking right now, I was listening to every word you said, and I'm thinking about England, how internationally they moved up to number four internationally, according to that assessment. Oh, I can't think of it.
The PISA.
Yeah, there you go. Say it one more time.
The PISA test.
The PISA. I think it's the PISA. There's another name, but it's one of these international.
OECD.
Say it again.
OECD.
That's where it comes from, but right. The PISA. But there's something else. But they just recently moved up. to number four, they have a phonics check there. All right. And yes, England is much smaller than the United States. So it's a little different. But I have to say that because they implemented a phonics check, it is, that's what people know. That's what they do. That's, everybody's on the same page. So there is something to say for that. And during the pandemic, where everybody was losing ground, England didn't. So, I mean, why aren't we looking at a country like England with a phonics check and seeing what they're doing? You know, I do think that's important, that we should kind of look maybe outside of our country and look at other countries and see what they're doing, what they're doing differently.
Hey, can I ask you something?
Yes.
Do they, does English have, England have a high ENL population like we do here, especially like
they have a significant, yes, they do. Yes,
special ed, bilingual classes. I mean,
yes, they do. It might not be the same exact, you know, demographics, but yes, they do. They do. If you look, it's not homogenous the way you would think. No,
I taught in England. I can definitely say there was a high ELL population, and I worked in a special education school. I don't know how representative that school was of the general population. But I will say the United Kingdom education system is the most high stress education system I worked in for teachers. It's
really,
yeah. Oh, it's so much more accountability than we have in Canada. Way more accountability. And it's stressful. You feel it. When I was there, you know, I worked 60, 70 hours a week for my school, like in the school building. And then like, I was like the lazy teacher in the building. I was in my early 20s when I was working there. I felt like people were judging me because I was only working 60, 70 hours. They're like, you're not coming in on Sunday to do an 8-hour shift of planning? And you're just
that,
like,
is that normal? I mean, or was it just your school? Was this a public school?
To be fair, it was a private school. However, I did get the vibe it was normal, in part because they have this ranking system where inspectors can come and randomly inspect your school. And if you get too low of a rank too many times in a row, they can even shut down your school. So like, there is a huge pressure put on teachers to make sure that when that inspector comes in, your classroom is like tip top. And, you know, when you give a grade in England, you know, you were really expected to really have hard evidence for your grade. I remember if I wanted to check off a learning goal in the school I was working in, I had to have three pieces of work from the student documenting that the student had mastered that goal, archived in a binder, ready to go in case anyone questioned one grade. And that would just be like one grade. That wasn't even their total grade. Like just any mark I gave, I had to be able to like pull out of my binder, here's my justification, which is just incredibly high stress system. So I've actually been kind of surprised that England doesn't have higher achievement, but I almost feel like they're almost too far on that end of the spectrum. It just felt very extreme when I was working there. It was very stressful.
Interesting. You know, I have some friends over there. I'm going to ask about that because that's the first.
I need to bring them onto the show, Faith.
Yeah. Well, we maybe that will be a show. We'll talk about that.
I worked in a private school like 7 years ago in England. So
yeah.
Maybe my experience isn't normal for today. I don't know.
Yeah. But I do think it is significant to point out this phonic check and that also they start at 4 years old, by the way, teaching kids. So, yeah, there's definitely a difference. So it is interesting to.
But you know, Faith, that's funny that you say that they start at four. I know there are some countries, I think maybe like Finland and Riga, Latvia, they start, I think, at seven. And
but it's not English speaking. See, it's not English speaking, and their code is a lot more transparent. You know, yeah, I'm talking about an English speaking country they start at 4 years old. Now, if it's a transparent code, it's a lot easier to learn, and maybe they could start later. Yeah.
And I want to throw out, because I did do an analysis on PISA scores a couple years ago. If you go to most blogs on what are the best education systems in the world, they're not actually usually referencing achievement. They're usually referencing qualitative factors. And people will cite like, oh, they don't start reading instruction until like grade one or grade two or something. Right. And the kids have 3 hours of recess a day and everyone's dancing and happy all the time.
Right.
Amazing. But they're not actually looking at the achievement. If you look at the countries with the highest achievement, it's almost exclusively Asian countries. And I've also worked in Asia, and I was definitely lots of explicit instruction, very systematic. And there was lots of tier one and tier three instruction. Now, again, I actually feel like, at least where I worked in Korea, and from what I've read about the Chinese and the Japanese education system, it's kind of too extreme. It's a very stressful education system. But I think it takes the fact that these are all the highest performing countries sort of takes the steam out of the argument that some of these Nordic countries where, you know, it seems very extreme constructivist, almost like everything is play-based learning for all of elementary school, are the best education systems in the world. I don't think that you often see the claim that like Norway and Finland are the best education systems in the world. I don't know, but there's actually any objective validity to that. I think it's just people like those education systems because they seem lovely, for lack of a better term. And I'm sure we got to find a balance between, you know, focusing on achievement and improving educational results.
Uh-oh, you said the word balance.
So
I've been banned from the show now.
No, never. So
never say never.
Sum up what you said here, Nate, is early phonics instruction starting in kindergarten, the inclusion of the five pillars of literacy instruction within course settings, a minimum of 80 hours plus of tier three systematic phonics instruction for struggling readers, and ongoing coaching to train teachers. Your last thoughts, Nate, before we wrap up.
No, I think that's totally what my findings were. And I actually think, for lack of a better word, that's the least sexy findings of a study ever, because that seems to be what every study on reading instruction shows. So I spent months and months of work analyzing NAP scores with the help of my co-founder, Joshua, and some support from Dr. Rachel Gabriel from LXD Research, only to confirm the exact same thing, basically, that the NRP report and Torgerson's 2009 literature review from roughly 20 years ago found. But it is nice to see that working on a state level. And if you don't mind, I'd love to give a little plug at the end of this, if that's okay.
Do it right now.
Do it.
Okay. Well, I am doing a charity giveaway this month. So if you heard about my book at all in this conversation and thought, oh, if that sounds interesting, I am donating 100% of profits to the food bank for the month of June. So if you would like to get the book, it's a great time to check it out.
We'll put your book in the notes, in the show notes as well. And
maybe with a live link or something, right, babe?
Yeah. And Judy, any last thoughts that you have that we might have missed?
So I think this conversation validates what I've known is important for a long time. We need that phonics instruction. We need to pay attention to the five pillars of literacy. We cannot neglect them. Literacy coaches, keep doing what you're doing. Even if the data is not shifting as fast as you want it to shift, stay the course. Slow and steady wins the race. Please, 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 teachers, coaches, administrators, the data is not going to shift in year one of implementation probably as much as you'd like it. Stay the course. Think carefully about how you're allocating the time in your literacy block. I know we mentioned a lot about tier one and tier three. Think about every piece of that pie, tier one, tier two, tier three. And the key that I think is missing from a lot of classrooms, and I hope that people listening today think about, is giving kids time to practice. Things that they're learning in isolation, if they're seeing these words and they're decoding them just in phonics, and then all of a sudden they're given an oral reading fluency or something like a cadence where they have to read the text, but they've never practiced reading text without those pictures and seeing lines of text on a page, they're not going to do well. So it has to become an authentic part of the day that kids are getting practice reading to a partner, reading to their parent, reading to the teacher, and also teachers, coaches, give those kids explicit feedback on what they're doing well or what they need to improve on. No more good job. I like the way you just slid through the word. Oh, I love the way that you just noticed that vowel team and it says E. Let's go through that word. Keep giving them feedback, but let's allocate our time and let's not have a fake MTSS system. I know we did one episode on that. It can't just happen for 3 weeks and then it stops and then, oh, next year we'll do better. It has to get better now.
So my last thought is we've known this for a long time, as you said, Nate. You know, I've been at this for a long time. I was part of Reading First. And, you know, I think all the things that you said, we knew over 20 years ago. And, you know, I'm hoping now things are a little bit different, that things are changing. But I do think it's important that people have realistic expectations when they are looking at these SOR laws across the country, thinking that that alone and getting a certain program in place is going to change the world. You know, it's not going to happen that way. And that's not opinion. You know, that's why we bring Nate on, because, you know, he's looking at this in a holistic way and he is digging deeply into these areas. And we appreciate that. So I do want to tell, you know, a note to, you know, to parents. When you are looking to push SOR laws, simultaneously, we need to make sure what we're doing, what's happening, are we clear about what the science really is and what it's not? Because sometimes what I'm seeing, especially on social media, is a lot is being pushed at people as if it's a done deal, as if we have all the science behind what some people are pushing. That's not the case. So those are my last thoughts, to be clear, and to really look at Nate's article, are SOR laws working? And in particular, the summary of what he said that outcome is. So I thank everyone for being with us today. Judy, hit it. And we didn't even use our BS button today.
I did. Oh, yeah, I did.
You did. I know you did. Oh. At one point, when did you use it? I don't even remember.
I think
Nate used the word balance, but not in the way that, you know.
Oh, okay. All right. It was just half up.
Yeah. And all right, so I'm finished with the last thoughts. Although I hope as these laws go into effect, if the research or something changes, think about that. The laws might need to change and shift. But anyway, follow me, Judy Boxner, on Twitter at Boxner Judy. Follow my beautiful Faith at Faith Borkowski on Twitter, on Instagram. Follow Faith at High Five Literacy. Follow me on Instagram at Boxner Damski. And then we have our Facebook group that's growing by the minute, the Literacy View, Real Teachers Letting Loose. Get down and dirty with us and join us. Everybody's invited.
Okay. Thank you again, Nate, and good night.
Thank you so much for having me on.